Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Amy is en route in. She's doing a little surveying of the Kennedy, see how, if this, the project, the three-year project, the Halt Your Life project, is already behind schedule and over budget. So she'll be in shortly. Speaking of which, how are you enjoying the Kennedy and the Chicago Expressway? So we haven't gotten to the discussion of that latest infrastructure project, right, to protect our ranking as the transportation hub of the Midwest, of course. But really, it provides an occasion to revisit one of the greatest op-eds that's ever been written about anything Chicago. And that was an op-ed over at Barstool Sports that was written about 4 years ago that ranked the Chicago highways. Do you recall this? Brilliant. Here is, it was a ranking from 10 to 1 from best or least worst to actual worst. Here's what Carl over at Barstool Sports in the stop ad, which I should repost just because it's a handy reference, handy for reference material. Here's what he wrote about the Kennedy 4 years ago. Can you imagine what he'd write about it in the coming years? And just so you know, if you're scoring at home, the ranking of the Kennedy in terms of top 10 worst Chicago expressways, number two, I'll leave it to you to guess which was number one. Here's his riff on the Kennedy. Three lanes for the most populated part of the state. And by the way, just as a quick tangent, I don't really even understand exactly what they're doing to the Kennedy, because it's not like you can expand it given the L and the exits. But anyway, I digress. All right, from the top, three lanes for the most populated part of the state. Mind-blowing blank. Worst part is sitting in traffic watching the blue line race by you while you're doing the mental math to figure out how much faster those blue line passengers will get to their destination than you. Northsiders see it as a point of pride. The view is pretty damn nice coming in, they say. But it comes with a cost. The traffic boils down to people not knowing how to exit in the loop, and that makes it all the way back to Rogers Park. It's not the people on 90 as much as it is the basic layout. How anyone thought we could be smart enough to navigate the exits on the Kennedy will always be beyond me. We were set up to fail with 90, the Kennedy, and thanks to decades of poor infrastructure decisions, it appears that tune isn't changing anytime soon. For the commuters, take the blue line or the Metra. You're a savage if you hit 90 in and out every single day. Get your head checked. 312-642-5600, turnkey.proanswerline. 64636DA, turnkey.pro text line for those already on their commute on the Kennedy or one of the other lovely expressways Chicago features. Please do give us a call with your perspectives, particularly with respect to the Kennedy, where, you know, you hear the travel times from Mike Scott on our newscast, and they're already a half hour longer than they normally are at those times during rush hour in the morning. Probably my favorite, even though it's not number one on the list, while you think about the Kennedy in the next 3 years of your life, if you're going to be in and out of Chicago on the Kennedy, I can't imagine that. I mean, I can't imagine the mental toll that will take on people. But my favorite description, even though is not number one on the list, is the Dan Ryan, which I take quite a bit to go back and forth from the city to Olympia Fields Country Club, but, or at least I used to. The Dan Ryan, the Wild West of the United States interstate. There is no speed limit and only one rule. Get the blank out of other people's way. The Ryan is flanked by some of the most dangerous neighborhoods in America, and God help anyone dumb enough to take Google Maps suggestion to get off at 47th and cut through some quaint side streets. No thanks. This is an all gas, no brakes stretch of highway, and you better respect it. Bonus points. It is impossible to get a speeding ticket on the Dan Ryan. Pure lawlessness. Same time, it would be nice if the Skyway didn't close the Mickey D's, because every good trip to the Horseshoe Casino involved at least one, most likely two, stops on the dollar menu. That was a special place. Yeah, we wax as nostalgic a bit there, but all gas, no brakes, and it's impossible to get a speeding ticket. That is actually why I enjoy the Dan Ryan. And also because, you know, basically very few people, except during rush hour, very few people leaving to go to the south suburbs, very people coming from the south suburbs back to Chicago on the other side. So it's not the worst place. The worst place, according to Carl, who, you know, I think deserves some recurring respect here for the thought he put into this and its biting accuracy. Number one worst expressway, 290. Despite that half-ass effort to deal with the Strangler 25 years ago under George Ryan. Remember that? How much did that alleviate the pressure? 290. Active shootings? Check. A decade worth of construction? Yep. How about one merge lane from the south? How about every inbound ramp after Sacramento being closed? How about the Hillside Strangler, a.k.a. when three major expressways all merge into one gigantic cluster blank tollway? Overall, 290 is the single worst commuting experience known to man. It's extremely dangerous, and save for about 3 hours an entire day, the thing is completely fracked start to finish. There's literally construction everywhere. Blue line, exit ramps, merge lanes, express lanes. God help anyone who has to rely on 290 in any regular capacity. It has no identity, no soul, and will do nothing but crush your spirits. Don't take the job that requires you to use this as your regular route to work, and in return, you can thank me for not hating your life. Great rants on the Chicago expressways. If you've got a favorite or most hated expressway, or a rant on one of them, please do give us a call. 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro, answer line, Mike, Southwest Side.
Hey, how are you doing, Dan? I can comment on all of the highways as I'm a professional driver.
Oh, there you go.
I think that the best highway is actually what they did on 90 going out after O'Hare, but all the
yes.
highways are garbage.
Yeah. Yeah, the expansion past the O'Hare toll plaza is helpful, but it only provides slight reprieve until you get to about Schaumburg, right?
No, I think you're right about that. I think, but if you look over at the whole system as a whole, the Dan Ryan is an absolute joke. 57's not too bad. I-80 through Joliet is absolutely horrible. 290, as you stated, is the number one worst. I can't stand it. I go around it every chance I get, and I try to avoid the Kennedy at all costs just because of the rant that Barstool put down. That is absolutely correct, and it's even worse now.
Thanks for the call, Mike. The other Mike in Plano.
Hey, guys, you know what? Yeah, that guy mentioned I-80. I take it to work to Tinley Park, and I got to go through Joliet. It is absolutely horrible. It's bumpy. It's broken. It's only two lanes until you get to New Lenox. And they've been doing expansion on it. The problem is they started maybe 4 years ago, and it's slated to be finished, I think, by 2025. So you're talking, it's only 16 miles of roadbed. It's taking them forever. And I get it with wintertime weather and, you know, there's other factors. I'm not an expert in road construction, so I understand there could be setbacks. But did we build the entire Hoover Dam structure in about 3 years? So I'm getting tired of it, especially these politicians here in Illinois that, you know, oh, work hard, play hard, we're blue collar. Well, where's the fruit to your work? You're not getting anything done. That's the end of my rant.
Thanks for the call, Mike. Yeah, I think we were talking about the Burn Interchange, a favorite project of the last couple of decades, which took longer to build than it took combined to build the Hoover Dam, the Golden Gate Bridge and the Empire State Building, I believe. But hey, you know, the city that works. On 80, since it was invoked twice, here's Carl from Barstool Sports' rant on that. I don't want to beat a dead horse here, but if you're commuting and you're on 80, your life blows. I was there for a long time. It sucked. 80 is the middle of nowhere. It's the casual divider between Chicagoland and the rest of the state. The traffic moves quick in extremely limited pockets. Everything else is fracked because, you guessed it, trucks. No offense, Mike, the semi-driver. Every single truck hitting the tri-state area is going through 80, and whether you like it or not, you're behind every single one of them. Bonus points for my Iowa guys that recognize 80 is the interstate you take to Paradise, a.k.a. Iowa City, but minus points that this is about commuting, and you seriously need to get therapy to work through the depression that comes with commuting on 80. Tom in Oswego.
Yeah, good morning, Dan and Amy. Since high school, which is over 45 years ago, 294 has been under construction. One portion or another. We used to go out to the dunes.
When did they take the toll plazas out? Remember the toll plazas were going to come out as soon as it was paid for.
Used to love the stopping at those, getting gas, going to the bathroom. Now they're gone. And what are they doing with all this money? Besides, they keep tearing up the darn road, and I'm on these roads all day. 294 has got to be the worst.
Thanks for the call, Tom. And per 294, Carl from Barstool Sports' riff on 294. I mean, these are so good. If you're on 294, you're miserable, and there's no other way to put it. Do you see, like, a recurring description of all these expressways? It's not like there's one Xanadu expressway. But anyway, only exception on 294 is when you're going to Six Flags and someone just got their license and in your group of high school friends, so you're cooking up to Gurney at 150 miles an hour in somebody else's dad's Nissan Altima. There's a toll every 6 miles and approximately 50,000 commercial trucks that White Sox Dave used to book freight for, getting in the way of literally every single move you have to make on 294. It's basically there to connect the western and northern suburbs with 80 and 57, definitely not the other way around. Somewhere, sometime, I can envision a bunch of millionaires from those suburbs privately funding 294 so they don't have to stomach the debauchery that is 9094 to the Dan Ryan. This was built to avoid all that, and in the process, they created an interstate that serves no other purpose but to connect a bunch of mid-market Chicago suburban employees with its miserable suburban workforce. It's dreary, depressing, and loaded with effing semis. Yeah. All right. Well, I mean, if you're grinding it out on the Kennedy or dodging bullets on the Dan Ryan or the Ike Reagan, just understand that everybody on every other expressway in Chicago is more or less similarly situated. So it's something that brings everybody in Chicago.
Hey, business owners, is your business and money in good hands? Does your bank invest in your success? Hi, Mike Gallagher here, letting you know that when you need a relationship bank, Signature Bank makes commercial banking personal. I love these guys. Not only do they have expansive industry experience, a strong financial track record, but they're also highly capitalized for strategic growth. That's so important. That's why Signature Bank is my bank. They know what it means to grow a business by designing solutions that are right for you and only you. These are real people. They're ready to help. So reach out to my friends at Signature Bank. Make the call today, 773-467-5630. 773-467-5630. Or visit them online at signaturebank.bank. That's signaturebank.bank. Your business could be Signature Bank's next success story. Go online, signaturebank.bank. Member FDIC. Equal housing lender. Signature Bank.
We'll land together. Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Before we turn our attention to TikTok and the testimony from its CEO, yesterday's House Committee hearing, since we were talking about Chicago expressways and since Amy was inspecting the Kennedy.
Oh, yeah. It's doing very well this morning.
Is it ahead of schedule and below budget?
Oh, yeah, right. I'm sure it'll be done in 3 years.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. I'm looking at seven people.
Before we turn our attention to that, let's stick local for a second here and talk a little bit about crime and a crime related to commuting, carjackings, and related crime. because I know failed mob banker Ali Giannoulias is sending out more press releases about what he's going to do about it. But before we even get to failed mob banker Ali G and his friends Josh Durango and others, this development in Seattle. Remember Seattle in 2020? It was the summer of joy, the autonomous zone. A former U.S. attorney, Jenny Durkin, the mayor,
right,
then allowed the city to be sacked by Black Lives Matter rioters, allowed a police precinct to be taken over and burned. Remember that?
Oh, I do. Very well, I remember it, yes.
Well, even in Seattle,
have they had enough?
To an extent. The city attorney there, who came into office in January of last year, her name is Ann Davison. She has taken, at least in part, a revolutionary approach. She believes that fighting crime is how you reduce crime. Now, follow me. I know we're talking to a largely Chicagoland audience, so this is going to be foreign. She believes that by pursuing habitual offenders and imposing, wait for it, punishment, you'll reduce crime. You believe this? Wow.
Wait, can you repeat that, sir?
Yeah. Yeah.
Huh?
No, I know. It's hard to connect those dots. This is you know, real deep thinking here. What she did, and this is what we talk about all the time on this show with respect to border security, with respect to domestic security. It is a small group of people that are responsible for a preponderance, if not a majority, of the crimes. And the first order of business is habitual offenders, particularly habitual violent offenders. And it will shock you how much you can increase the peace if you just went after. And I'm not saying you should just exclusively go after them, of course. But if you prioritize, first and foremost, habitual offenders. That's what she did. She focused on 168 repeat offenders responsible for a disproportionate amount of the crime in Seattle and Kings County. 168 people responsible for more than 3,500 misdemeanors in Seattle over a five-year period. That's about six misdemeanors per person, right?
They're professional misdemeanors.
More than, well, they averaged, I guess, six. The most common crimes were theft to buy fentanyl or meth, which often led to more serious charges, such as assaults and robbery if someone had attempted to stop them and so forth. That this is, again, according to the Seattle City Attorney's Office. So what's happened since she decided to focus on habitual offenders and punish them? On her watch, the number of annual misdemeanor referrals by this group of 168 has dropped to 2.7. Been reduced by a factor of three. In the past year, 142 of Seattle's top 168 recidivists were behind bars at some point. King County Jail has limited bookings for most misdemeanors, but last spring, Ms. Davison brokered an agreement to make an exception for Seattle's most prolific misdemeanor criminals. This is sort of a application of broken windows policing or prosecuting, I should say. She also pushed through a reform that excludes from Seattle's notoriously lenient community court anyone who had 12 or more charges referred to the city attorney for prosecution over the past 5 years. She, of course, was criticized. And by the way, she's not a MAGA person. She's not a conservative. She was criticized by Seattle's Marxists, but she pushed forward anyway. And so, lo and behold, and this again is habitual offenders. I think that I made that clear with the data I related, but and the impact you can have. It's just not that complicated. We make it so much more complicated. It is all the other societal ills in terms of educational opportunity and job opportunity and it's skills training. You can have all those conversations, but this is the primary one. And this is the very straightforward approach to addressing this primary responsibility of government at any level. And so it could happen in Chicago and Cook County, but we've chosen so far to ignore this axiom that pursuing habitual criminals and punishing them is how you reduce crime. Instead, what do? We have our Secretary of State say he's going to throw some money around to law enforcement to go after carjackers. What does that do?
I don't know. I mean, Alexei Janulius, Ali G, as we call him, got up there and talked about he can understand, Dan, because he was carjacked his senior year in high school.
I was a victim of carjacking when I was a senior in high school, and it was a horrendously scary experience, something that has stayed with me and my friends that were in the vehicle that day.
Yeah, I remember that when that happened.
Yeah.
Here's the backstory.
Please.
Josh Durango caught him after school, and he said, "Tell your dad he is going to give me that money." This family, that guy, that guy is the worst. He's just he's a dope. He is a leech. And it's only because of the lack of an existence of a Republican Party and the rank ignorance of a majority of the electorate in Illinois that a doofus, a bottom feeder like that guy is a statewide office holder. And I got to tell you, Tony Turlato, and I don't know, I didn't know Tony Turlato.
Who's Tony Turlato for us pedestrians?
I will get to it. Tony Turlato must be spinning in his grave, because everything I know about the Turlato family, the winemakers and... Tony Turlato was the patriarch. Ali G is married to one of his daughters.
Oh, okay.
He's since passed. Tony Turlato, everything I know about him for people who did know him is that he was this great guy and sensible guy. He must be spinning in his grave. Well, he must have been biting his tongue before he passed, that one of his daughters would marry such a character as Ali G. I mean, you know, we talk so much about Pritzker and Lightfoot and Fox and Preckwinkle and Evans and so on and so forth. There are so many oleaginous hacks in the political arena in Illinois and in public office, more to the point, like Ali G. I mean, it just makes me sick.
I know.
He almost makes me more violently not ill, I don't know, either just violent, just draws a visceral response because he's just such a bad person.
Well, such no, a, but on such the commercials, he's such a great guy. He coaches Dan. He gives back to the community.
He's such a non-entity. Don't you get tired in the state and in the city and in the county of electing these disreputable, bottom-feeding non-entities like Ali G.? It's a pathetic reflection on your own patheticness.
Yeah, but people
Chicago
know
electorate.
What you know. I know. But he's a victim, Dan. Don't forget.
The bottom line is that people shouldn't have to fear that they'll be robbed of their vehicle at gunpoint when they get into their car each day.
Well, wow. Those powerful words from the Secretary of State.
Much safer.
Hey, doofus.
Yes.
I mean, I'm talking about Ali G,
know,
of course.
I know.
See if you can hire some people who actually know how to run a business, who aren't living the high life off of $300 million bailout by taxpayers of your
bank
family's failed mob bank. Scumbag. Just find some people who actually know how to run a business to get, you know, people through the line faster at the DMVs. Why don't you do that?
He didn't even explain what the $21 million is for. Maybe this will help.
And now having three daughters of my own, the thought of that happening and my kids' lives being at stake is something that scares me.
To stop crime, you got to solve crime. And to solve crime, you have to have the resources.
The Chicago Police Department.
I mean, it's just, what is this $21 million going for?
Who's the father of Ali G's three daughters? Does anyone know?
Dan.
All right. So with respect to the $21 million.
Yeah. Look, $21 million. What are we getting? What are we getting?
You got a press release. You had a press conference. You'd everybody get to inveigh on the topic and pat themselves on the back and then, you know, resume as you were. What do we have? 2,000 carjackings in Chicago in January?
Yeah. I mean, I went to the pound and there was a whole row of carjack vehicles that were, you know, abandoned because normally they carjack you and then they do a joyride or commit crimes and then they dump it. You guys would not believe rows and rows and rows of cars that were carjacked.
Since we don't have a prosecutor who wants to do even
diddly what squat,
the Seattle city attorney is doing, Seattle prosecutor is doing, to go after habitual offenders, remove them from society, impose a cost. Since we don't have anything like that, we don't have any leadership from the mayor's office. We don't have any leadership from the court system. Why don't some of these other guys, like let them get into the act. Throw some money around. Throw some money at the Illinois State Police. Throw some money at CPD. And everybody can stand up at a podium in front of the cameras and say, look, we're getting serious about carjacking. Hey, you know what? Carjacking's a problem. You have a right to live in the city and not be carjacked. Oh, my gosh. Thank you so much.
Well,
these people are getting serious about carjackings now.
Well, it's hitting home because Liz Nagy from ABC7, her husband, John Hendren, was held at gunpoint, gun to his head, to get his car.
We want people to know that we both had guns. One pressed it against the side of my head, and they said, give me the keys.
Yeah,
I live in the South Loop. I don't live in Baghdad. And suddenly, I go to Target, and I'm not safe at this place. I've gone hundreds of times.
Yeah, he was parked in the second row at Target, and a person, he said, nonchalantly just walked up, held a gun to his head, got in the car, and then he gave him the car. Obviously, he didn't fight back, but I mean, that's, so then, you know, now reporters' husbands are getting carjacked at gunpoint with guns to their head.
What is
during
that mean?
The middle
what,
of the
what,
day.
What does that mean? Now reporters' husbands, are they a special class of people?
No, they're not. I'm just saying, but now they're part of the, now maybe some reporters are waking up to the reality that the rest of us live in.
Yeah, they literally are getting mugged by reality, like that happened to the CNN reporter in San Francisco when they got their stuff stolen.
Yeah,
it literally takes getting mugged by reality. But that's with everything in Chicago and Illinois. It literally has to happen. Something bad has to happen to me before I consider it a problem. We're so other regarding, and the Marxist left is so concerned about the community and vulnerable communities and minority communities, and they're always doing so much, but they could give a rat's ass about what happens to any individual in those communities until and unless it happens to them. And all of a sudden, a reporter's husband got carjacked. Now it's serious. Terry Duffy's wife, the chairman of the CME, his wife gets carjacked, and now all of a sudden it's serious, and the elites are going to opine on this, and it's crazy. It's absurd. Yeah, I know. It's been crazy and absurd for a long time. It's just been crazy and absurd mainly for people who don't matter to the people in charge. But the people who don't matter to the people in charge need to understand that that's their perspective on you. And that's the disconnect that has spelled the descent into madness for Chicago and Illinois. They don't know that the people like Ali G standing before a podium don't care about them. You are cannon fodder. You are mascots. And until there is an awakening to that reality and corrective action taken, like throwing these people that have been shining you on all this time out of office, then nothing is going to change.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line 64636, type in DA, then a quick comment. The $21 million is in grants to police departments and task force, ready, across the state in an effort to tamp down on carjackings. Well, it's another money grab. I don't even know what that means. What does that even mean?
What?
Well, what are we, you're getting grants to police departments to do what?
Okay, right. I don't know. Put you know.
Overtime, pay officers, for hire more officers, what?
Money's fungible. The whole point is just to say my agency's involved so I can stand in front of a podium, so I can go on the campaign trail, so I can cut commercials in 4 years saying I was involved in trying to stop carjacking, and some you'll get some cardboard cutout human being in a police uniform next to stand next to you.
Right.
And the electorate will be guffawed as per usual.
Yep. That's exactly what they did yesterday. A number of law enforcement agencies in uniform standing next to them. Because I'm doing something. I care.
Hey, if I give your department $5 million, will you stand next to me at a press conference? Sure. Okay. That's policy making in Illinois.
Woo! Yes, love it.
Roger, Southside.
Hello, my friends. One thing. Why have we in Illinois allowed such crime to be rites of passage here? Do you know what I'm saying? Whether it be carjacking, why hasn't the good, the right stood up and said, hey, listen, you want to stop carjacking in Illinois or the city? You can stop in 2 weeks if you want. 2 weeks with about 20 police officers. But listen, you can't scrutinize these people, though. In 2 weeks, you could send a message here.
What does that mean? Okay. You can't scrutinize who? We're not going to do Colombian death squads. But
no, I didn't say it. Listen, no. Okay. But what you have now, Dan, is you have the needle is swung 180 degrees the other way.
I understand.
Okay. Carjacking should be a minimum. Okay. If you put your, the way most of these go down, somebody putting a gun on somebody, okay, and attack them in their car, should be minimum 30 years without parole. Okay, you want to take that chance? Okay, but here's our problem here. Okay, from Tony Blue Suit all the way on down and all our lawmakers that they dictate to, okay, they're not going to do that. Okay, what we've done here is we have legalized animal farm. It's kind of like the guy that farts in the room, but nobody can say anything about it. Or the guy that stinks. Nobody.
That's really vivid. Thank you for that simile.
Tell me how I'm wrong. Yeah. I'm not wrong. Okay?
I'm not saying you're wrong. I just wish you would have chosen a different simile. But yeah.
Yeah, fine. But that's what it is here. But until people in Chicago and in Illinois realize what it is, because that's exactly what it is. What about our illustrious Sheriff Dart? He's got his own.
I know, that's all of them.
Detail.
It's all of them. Okay. Thanks for the call, Roger. I mean, yes, it's Animal Farm, right? And everyone's equal, except some are more equal than others. I got it. George in Naperville.
Dan, Lightfoot's tenure needs to be memorialized by a structure worthy of her legacy. I propose Lightfoot Tower. It will reach into the sky. The city of Chicago should purchase all the autos that were carjacked, stack them on a pole, and Joe Perillo, the car dealer, can cut the ribbon at the opening ceremony.
I like that. That's like a reprisal of the old spindle in Berwyn, right? Right?
Yeah. Joe Perillo wants to come on the show.
Put all the carjacked cars in the spindle.
I couldn't believe it. First of all, vehicles are stolen. I mean, they come to the pound every minute on the hour. And sometimes the most they ever had was almost 300 in a 24-hour period of cars that were not carjacked, but the ones that were stolen. And then you add in carjackings, and it's over 300. They had to open up another city pound to accommodate for the people who are stealing people's cars.
We need to do something like the gun buyback program for cars, where no questions asked. You just turn in the car that you carjacked, and we give you some money for it.
We got our car stolen, and thank God. The one good thing Mayor Lightfoot did was, because you used to have to pay to get you'd get carjacked or your car would be stolen. It was recovered. You had to pay $250.
Yeah, of course.
To get your car back. So she eliminated that. But the line was so
wonderful.
Long, and I was just hearing story after story. So where was your car stolen from? So where was your car stolen? And I met a woman. She was badly beaten, visiting from 3 hours away. She was parked her car outside the United Center somewhere, and they wouldn't give her her car because she didn't actually have the paper police report. And like, look at her. She was victimized. Give her her car so she can get the hell out of Chicago.
Maybe we should.
And I helped her out, and I helped her out because that's what I do. I help people.
Yeah, of course. You're the city's heroine.
Fixer. Well, I've got numbers where people don't, regular people don't have numbers. I have numbers and I help people.
Yeah, you know a guy, right?
No, I do know a guy. And I got the police report and she was able to get her car out and not pay for it and get the hell out of Chicago. But she was badly beat. I mean, it's just.
I'm sure Mayor Brandon Johnson will give you a key to the city.
No, he's going to fire me for my other job when he becomes mayor.
I'm just trying to be creative here. If we could solve, use one problem to solve another. Maybe we can subsidize these carjackers to only carjack gas guzzlers, and then we'll replace them with the green energy cars. There's got to be a way to, use their skills to advance the larger agenda of saving the planet if we can't save the city. I don't know. I got to workshop that. But I'm just trying to think, since we've sort of conceded the underlying point of endemic violence. Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Big day on the Hill yesterday. TikTok's relatively little-known CEO, a gentleman named Xiao Chu.
Yeah, Xiao Chu looked a little nervous yesterday, huh?
He's Singaporean, from Singapore. He is the CEO of TikTok, and he was there to get grilled by the House Energy and Commerce Committee. And the question that's at bar right now, within the halls of power on the Hill, ban TikTok, as many states have already moved to do so on the devices of state employees, the state provided devices of state employees. Same thing at the municipal level. Ban it, force a sale, or leave it alone. Is this a tool of the Chinese Communist Party that we should be deeply concerned about, that implicates our national security and the privacy of 150 million American citizens? Or is this just another social media platform and should be treated the same way as Facebook or Twitter, Instagram, or anything else? Here is what TikTok CEO Xiao Chu said in his opening statement. A couple of topics he tackled in his 5 minutes. First, on protecting young people. Remember back before COVID, we used to be concerned about screen time and young people, teens and pre-adolescents being fixated on their phones in particular. Here's what Xiao Chu had to say about that.
We forbid direct messaging for people under 16, and we have a 16-minute watch time by default for those under 18. We have a suite of family pairing tools so that parents can participate in their teens' experience and make the choices that are right for their family. We want TikTok to be a place where teenagers can come to learn, which is why we recently launched a feed that exclusively features educational videos about STEM. STEM videos already have over 116 billion views on TikTok. And I think TikTok is inspiring a new generation to discover a passion for math and science.
Mm-hmm. See?
Anybody hang out with teenagers? Because I have a few that I live with.
Well, I mean, your eldest. I mean, Peyton is going to Georgia Tech and he's majoring in engineering.
And he's home right now. No, he's not watching STEM.
Well, okay, but he is in STEM. Right?
Yes. I'm sorry.
Okay. All right. It just didn't tickle me the same way that it tickles you. I get it.
Because I hang out with people who make TikToks all the time, and it's not, they're not doing it for them. Okay, go on. Sorry. I'll compose myself.
Okay. So that was on protecting teens. And you got to give the guy a chance to have his say.
Please.
And I got to say, if you were going to, and I'm not saying he is, but there's a problem with his testimony, which we'll get to. But if you were going to identify sort of a Manchurian candidate to be the CEO of TikTok and be relatively convincing and sympathetic, this Xiao Chu guy would be the guy. He's clearly a smart guy, and he is a pretty good communicator. He comes across as very authentic. The problem is the backstory, and the backstory is super important. But again, let's let him finish his say, addressing the issue that TikTok is Chinese communist dominated, the parent company ByteDance, which is controlled by the Chinese communists. Chinese communists have already responded. President Xi and the Politburo there in Beijing has said, we will oppose a forced sale of TikTok. If that's something that you would want to try to do, you regulators in America. Here's Xiao Chu on TikTok and what kind of company it is and who owns it and who makes decisions.
ByteDance is not owned or controlled by the Chinese government. It's a private company. 60% of the company is owned by global institutional investors. 20% is owned by the founder and 20% owned by employees around the world. ByteDance has 5 board members. 3 of them are American. Now, TikTok itself is not available in mainland China. We're headquartered in Los Angeles and in Singapore, and we have 7,000 employees in the U.S. today. Still, we have heard important concerns about the potential for unwanted foreign access to U.S. data and potential manipulation of the TikTok U.S. ecosystem. Our approach has never been to dismiss or trivialize any of these concerns. We have addressed them with real action. Now, that's what we've been doing for the last 2 years, building what amounts to a firewall that seals off protected U.S. user data from unauthorized foreign access. The bottom line is this. American data stored on American soil by an American company overseen by American personnel. We call this initiative Project Texas. That's where Oracle is headquartered. Today, U.S. TikTok data is stored by default in Oracle servers. Only vetted personnel operating in a new company called TikTok U.S. Data Security can control access to this data. Now, additionally, we have plans for this company to report to an independent American board with strong security credentials.
Right, he's talking about Oracle. Okay, well, that's a pretty good cover story.
Yeah, it's a great story. You know, we employ Americans. What's not to love about our company? We're based in LA and in Singapore. We're not China related.
Three of the 5 board members of TikTok are Americans. Unfortunately, all 3 are named Hunter Biden. That's the problem. No. But Kathy McMorris Rogers, who's the chairwoman of the Energy and Commerce Committee, she picked up right after Mr. Chu finished his opening statement and went through a number of names of senior leadership at ByteDance, the parent company of TikTok. And they have something in common. They're also in the upper reaches of the Chinese Communist Party.
All of these individuals work or are affiliated with the Chinese Communist Party and are at the highest levels of leadership at ByteDance, a company where you previously served as the chief financial officer and where you regularly communicate with their CEO. TikTok has told us that you weren't sharing data with the CCP, but leaked audio from within TikTok has proven otherwise. TikTok told us that you weren't tracking the geolocation of American citizens. You were. TikTok told us you weren't spying on journalists. You were. In your testimony, you state that ByteDance is not beholden to the CCP. Again, each of the individuals I listed are affiliated with the Chinese Communist Party, including Zhang Fuping, who is reported to be the Communist Party secretary of ByteDance, and who has called for the party committee to, quote, take the lead across all party lines to ensure the algorithm is enforced by, quote, correct political direction. Just this morning, the Wall Street Journal reported that the CCP is opposed to a forced sale of TikTok by ByteDance, quoting a CCP spokesman as saying the Chinese government would make a decision regarding any sale of TikTok. So the CCP believes they have the final say over your company. I have zero confidence in your assertion that ByteDance and TikTok are not beholden to the CCP.
Now, to be fair to the Chinese Communist Party, you know, Obama's Department of Justice under Eric Holder also spied on journalists. So it's not like something only that TikTok and the Chinese communists do. It's also something that we do here, depending on the regime in D.C. But the larger point, which was made by Representative McMorris Rodgers at the end of her time, is this.
To the American people watching today, hear this. TikTok is a weapon by the Chinese Communist Party to spy on you, manipulate what you see, and exploit for future generations. A ban is only a short-term way to address TikTok, and a data privacy bill is the only way to stop TikTok from ever happening again in the United States. I yield back.
So ban for sale, leave it alone. Treat it like any other social media platform in America. 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line. 64636-DA, turnkey.pro text line. That's a question.
Yeah, that is a good question. We got a text message. And what are the odds on TikTok hiring Hunter Biden on for their board to make this all go away?
Washington Post survey finds 41% of Americans support a federal ban on TikTok. 25 oppose it. 71% are concerned that TikTok's parent company is based in China. So I don't know. I mean, it's, you know, it's a bit of a complicated issue. It's a bit of an esoteric issue, particularly as you go up the age demographic. There's probably you get a smaller number of people who understand the platform, who utilize the platform, who maybe appreciate the dynamics of the back and forth that was had yesterday between Mr. Chu and the members, both Democrats and Republicans, actually, for the most part. I mean, there were exceptions or people that oppose banning TikTok, Democrats that oppose banning TikTok. But for the most part, there was a pillaring of Mr. Chu by both Democrats and Republicans. But it's sort of popular, particularly when you cast it as a national security issue, as you cast it as a data privacy issue. And I do believe that there are some, at minimum, troubling ties to the Chinese Communist Party. But it's all, and I also understand that there's really no such thing as private enterprise in China under Xi, particularly if you're a business of a particular size, certainly as one as big as TikTok and ByteDance, its parent company. But I hesitate to completely rally around the flag too of people that, you know, of politicians in either party that always cloak themselves in national security when they're setting about to eradicate things.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Banning things, I know. Well, if you have TikTok on your phone, I would delete the app because I had it on my phone. I didn't even know, and I've been hacked, and I'm thinking it's a possibility that they did it through TikTok.
Maybe somebody can ask Xiao Chu about your hack before he leaves town, goes back to Singapore.
I'm just saying you leave yourself vulnerable.
All right, so a more serious person than most of the people that spoke yesterday, yes. And a more knowledgeable person. He's also a member of Congress, but he was also he served our country in the Marine Corps. He's an intelligence officer. Mike Gallagher from Green Bay.
Isn't he great?
I don't agree with everything, but he's very very smart.
Right.
And he's very thoughtful, and he does his homework. And so it makes him a really interesting guy to listen to. He's somebody that I think we should listen to and say, like, this is a guy who knows a lot of things, and he knows more things than we know. So you may not draw every conclusion that he draws, but you should listen to him because he has a wide base of knowledge and he is studying and thinking about these issues. And I actually went to a talk. I think I mentioned that maybe when we were talking to Carafano or Gordon Chang earlier in the week. And they both respect Gallagher. But I went to a talk he gave and it was very, very good. And the Q&A was even better. A very, very knowledgeable guy, layered knowledge of this. And he's the chairman of the House Select Committee on the Chinese Communist Party. And he chose to name that committee the House Select Committee on the Chinese Communist Party because it's not China. It's not China, the Chinese people. It's the Chinese Communist Party. understanding what their intentions are, understanding what their program is, understanding where their strengths and weaknesses are. And this is what he said about TikTok a couple weeks back in an interview he gave on Firing Line on PBS.
None of these highly addictive social media apps are good for us on some level. But what makes TikTok different is the basic ownership structure. TikTok is owned by ByteDance, and ByteDance is effectively controlled by the Chinese Communist Party. Furthermore, the notion that a private company exists in China, I think, is tenuous at best, because all companies are subject to the whims of the Chinese Communist Party. And so that is the basic difference. Here in America, if the government demands something, there are at least protections for private companies. In China, those protections don't exist. So that's the fundamental difference. The other thing I think we have to concede is that the TikTok is so successful because the algorithm is better at addicting kids. And that's why the comparison to fentanyl, I think, is appropriate. The real concern with TikTok is not just that the app can track your location, which it can. And TikTok was caught like trying to track the location of journalists, and they lied about it initially, and then they blamed it on bad actors in the company. So the threat is not just that it could track your location or exfiltrate data. The threat is that increasingly it's a news source for young Americans. It's not just about dumb dance videos. It is a source of information. So the question we have to ask ourselves, do we want a CCP-controlled company to be the dominant media platform in America? And I have to believe we can come to a compromise in the form of a forced sale to an American company that satisfies my national security concerns while still allowing the app to exist in some form.
Mm-hmm. It's a reasonable posture. But I have to say, I mean, because Jim Freeman in the Wall Street Journal made the same point. So, you know, if you force a sale, I mean, why would the Chinese communists, why would Beijing oppose this? I mean, if you IPO'd this thing, it would be a windfall for TikTok and those who have an equity stake in TikTok and ByteDance.
Right.
But that's true. So you say, well, that so there's some other motivation here. However, again, to be fair, because this is more complicated than some of the more jingoistic people want to make it. There's a lot of privately held companies in this country. Privately held companies by Americans, like patriotic, law-abiding Americans, that could be taken public and could be a windfall for the founder and those with an equity stake in those companies, but they choose to keep it private because they don't want to be subject to the whims of shareholders. They don't want to be answerable to corporate boards that if they say the wrong thing, they can be taken away from them, particularly in these days in America. So it's a little bit more complicated than just saying Beijing would not support a for sale of TikTok. Therefore, there is something nefarious afoot at TikTok. That doesn't necessarily logically follow, even though I concede what Mike Gallagher is saying about ByteDance and what Representative McMorris Rogers said about ByteDance as well. They're right. And so clearly, Mr. Chu is not telling the whole story when he talks about the independence of TikTok vis-a-vis ByteDance, vis-a-vis the Chinese Communist Party. But, you know, there's a couple of steps that you have to take here. And unfortunately, not our listeners, but most Americans don't have the attention span for it to get into the weeds here a bit on it.
I got to tell you, though, I love what Governor Cox in Utah did. To get TikTok, you need parental consent. And then he signed a bill yesterday that prohibits kids under 18 from using social media between the hours of 10:30 p.m. and 6:30 a.m. requiring age verification for anyone who wants to use social media in the state.
Did he have anything else to say? Did he have any revelations he wanted to make to people? Spencer Cox,
if you haven't seen that video or heard it, go treat yourself to him. What was he was talking to transgender kids, right? When
he is one of the more sprightly governors in the country, I'd say. Just an observation.
As you said after that segment, does his wife know?
Yeah. I tell people that
in Utah all the time. They laugh out loud. Because
terrible when she's
knows.
The last to know.
It's horrible when your wife is, last to know.
It's
hard to process.
It's hard. Right.
But anyway, so he did that, and I thought, I don't
need the state to be a parent. I don't need the state to be mom and dad. So no. These are decisions that every American family needs to make and needs to be engaged in to make. Yep. And if you want to cede your sovereignty, your personal sovereignty to the state, if you want to cede your parental responsibility to the state, I mean, you can try to do that, but I'm going to resist because the state doesn't raise kids, never has, never will.
Well, they're trying to
paraphrasing Bill Bennett. And that is the road to serfdom. And I don't want to travel on it, even if other people are excited to do so.
Yeah, again, they said, it's an addiction like a drug.
Well, I mean, again,
scare kids. I mean, yes, I'm just saying that's the reason behind signing this.
I understand. And that's why Mike Gallagher called it digital fentanyl, which is what he was referring to in that excerpt you heard. But so that's where parents need to step in. Something else. Well, let's take Bill in LaSalle County. Something else I want to get to, though, about how the platform operates, too, because there was a really good 60 Minutes. Don't get to say that very much anymore. Really good 60 Minutes piece on social media platforms generally, and it included TikTok a couple of months back that we covered.
Yeah,
this
we'll
was back
get
in
to
November.
That later.
But anyway, Bill in LaSalle County.
Hey, good morning. Thanks for taking my call. If you remember, President Trump basically blocked Huawei from doing business in America with its 5G systems.
Yeah.
And all it took was hiring John Podesta as soon as Biden got in office, and Huawei's back in America. So all TikTok needs to do is hire John Podesta and the Democratic Mafia.
Thanks for the call.
Yeah, I got a text message. Should have paid attention. When President Trump wanted to ban TikTok while it was launching.
Well, I mean, those things are going on. But the question is that what you want to see happen? Are you paying enough attention to these social media platforms, to screen time? And that includes phone time with your kids. Is that something that's a big deal again now that we're on the other side of COVID? At least most of us are. We'll take your reactions to that question.
Mess Dan Prof going head to head with Juan Williams on Tuesday, April 25th at Beyond the Talking Points. Get your tickets today at 560theanswer.com/beyond.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. We're talking about the hearing yesterday, the House Energy and Commerce Committee.
Yeah.
With TikTok CEO Xiao Chu. And I do want to say something about congressional committees. And I think many of our listeners will understand this because they pay attention to this stuff. They've seen this act before. But it does bear repeating, particularly when it's being driven by Republicans, so that there's an understanding we're even-handed here. These committee hearings are not usually the way to generate too much light because they're mainly opportunities for members of the committees to take up their 5 minutes, either blowing sunshine in the direction of a witness or excoriating a witness. They ask questions they don't really want an answer to, or they ask questions that are impossible to answer in the form that they're presented. You know, blah, 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 blah. Yes or no, yes or no, yes or no.
Answer the question.
And that was done a lot yesterday, and it's unproductive.
Well, but it's self-serving to the politician, or at least they think that it is. Like, look, I'm doing something.
And done by Republicans, right? It's the tough talk, I'm taking a hard line kind of thing, in this case with the Chinese communists vis-a-vis TikTok.
Don't mistake activity for accomplishment.
There are some times where you have good exchanges back and forth, but, I mean, if you don't want to get an answer to a question, then don't ask it, or just, I'm just going to use my 5 minutes to offer my version of events. Fine. It's unfortunate. It's just unhelpful, and I don't think it drives much more of an understanding. It just gets people locked into their talking points and the position that they've been told by leadership to take on a particular issue. And again, both directions. So, for example, Chairman McMorris Rodgers, she had some good points when she was talking about specific people that are in senior leadership at ByteDance and in senior leadership of the Communist Party. That's substantive knowledge that people should have. But when she like puts it to him, yes or no, can you guarantee me 100% this and that? It's just, eh. And then it's all just a setup for her to say this thing needs to be banned and you need to pass my Digital Privacy Act. Now, the flip side of that is a goofball like Jamal Bowman, who's a newly minted member of Congress from New York and a member of the squad. He is apparently a man, but that's, I guess, open for debate. He was outside the Capitol after the hearing having like a rally for TikTok. Don't ban TikTok, saying this.
You know, Robert, I just realized something. Republicans ain't got no swag. That's why they want to ban TikTok. Republicans ain't got no swag. That's the problem.
That's my
and I mentioned that in the context of engaging young people in the democratic process.
And that's my new T-shirt. Republicans ain't got no swag. Boom. I'm going to start selling them tomorrow on Twitter.
Oh,
wait.
God.
Don't
meaningless. Yeah, these are the phrases they use. Engaging young people in democracy. Right. Well, since Mr. Bowman, Representative Bowman, gave us the opportunity, going back to this piece that 60 Minutes did in November of last year, which looked at political polarization on social media, but not just political polarization. Specific to this conversation about that political polarization is a bit anodyne, but specific to TikTok, there were some really interesting points made, in particular by Tristan Harris, who is a social media veteran. He was at Facebook. Now he started this organization called the Center for Humane Tech. He was behind the documentary Social Dilemma about Facebook and the platforms. And he made this point about TikTok, well, TikTok China versus TikTok in the West.
In their version of TikTok, if you're under 14 years old, they show you science experiments you can do at home, museum exhibits, patriotism videos, and educational videos. And they also limit it to only 40 minutes per day. Now, they don't ship that version of TikTok to the rest of the world. So it's almost like they recognize that technology is influencing kids' development, and they make their domestic version, a spinach version of TikTok, while they ship the opium version to the rest of the world. There's a survey of preteens in the US and China asking, what is the most aspirational career that you want to have? And the US, the number one was influencer.
Social media influencer.
And in China, the number one was astronaut.
Oh.
Again, you allow those two societies to play out for a few generations, I can tell you what your world is going to look like.
Wow.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro, answer line, 646-36-DA, turnkey.pro. Now, you could play devil's advocate, as I will here, and say, well, TikTok, American-based company, as Xiaoqiu mentioned.
Yeah, they employ 7,000 people.
7,000 employees here, based in L.A., Oracle is some sort of de facto ombudsman. And so what do? Well, we ship versions of TikTok, if you will, to places per the government's constraints on what TikTok can be in China versus what TikTok can be in America. And in TikTok, TikTok, you can make TikTok spinach or you can make TikTok opium. In China, the government is mandating spinach.
You're darn right they are.
So I'm trying to have
more solid citizens later on that are knowledgeable and STEM oriented.
Yeah, well, okay. So I'm not suggesting that TikTok is independent of the Chinese Communist Party and thus the Chinese government. I'm just suggesting that's something that they could offer up as a explanation for why the versions of TikTok and what is or is not allowed in the platform vary by country. But it also, so it could speak to alignment I mean, theoretically, although there's a lot more evidence to suggest to the contrary, it could speak to independence. But the underlying point is, whether it's independence or alignment, the Chinese approach, remember, these are communists,
right,
versus America's approach. What's your preference? Now, when you attach those countries' names to it, does that make you queasy at all to model America's approach to social media platforms like TikTok on China's approach to the same platforms?
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro, answer line 64636. Type in DA, then a quick comment.
Jim in Chicago.
Yeah, hi, good morning. Fauci was absolutely befuddled by that chipmunk on speed, who, Jim Jordan from Ohio, and then the guy on Downers from Kentucky, the quack Rand Paul, with the game of function over and over again, badgered a scientist, a brilliant scientist, by two imbeciles, was incredible. And only the Republicans could pull that off. I watched a lot of Senate inquiries, and that took the cake. That actually took the cake. Hello?
Hello, exactly. Like
that took the cake.
What planet are you visiting from? First of all,
Jim Jordan.
First of all,
Jim Jordan is insane.
Yeah, right. Jim Jordan's insane. So, Jim, we're talking about, I guess you're just talking about just generally congressional hearings, and you're just going to pick one that you want to talk about. Is that it? You don't want to talk about TikTok? You want to talk about what was talked about yesterday?
And the worst that ever.
And so what you want to talk about, Tony Fauci? How is Tony Fauci's testimony in Congress held up to what we know to be true, Jim?
He said to make that into a disease, you'd have to make a Chevrolet into a motorcycle, or vice versa.
To make what?
They had no way of. He said to make COVID-19 out of that lab would be like making a Chevrolet into a motorcycle.
Tony Fauci said that, and the Department of Energy is saying something else, aren't they, Jim?
No, they're full of blow. You're just using
the
political weapon.
Oh, I got it, Jim. Right. The Department of Energy is full of baloney, and Dr. Marty Makary at Johns Hopkins is full of baloney. Yeah. All the people, Dr. Robert Redfield, an infectious disease expert, the former head of the CDC, he's full of baloney. Because if they don't agree with Jim from Chicago, they're full of baloney. And Jim from Chicago can't contemplate any other topic besides ranting about going off topic to rant about Jim Jordan and Rand Paul. I mean, again, I guess tangentially it relates to my commentary on congressional hearings, but you're a good example of sort of the Jamal Bowman problem that I identified. And again, I made the point about don't ask questions you don't want answers to, or if you're trying to be fair-minded, if you're trying to give somebody a chance, if you want somebody to actually answer a question, then you have to let them answer it. Yeah, okay. But I mean, Jim, in Chicago, you're an example of that which you pretend to decry. And of course, the irony is lost on you because you're the typical Chicago voter, aren't you, Jim? Frank in Arlington Heights.
See what we're dealing with here?
Hey, good morning.
Exactly.
With technology and kids, you know, this isn't about TikTok so much, but it's about that ChatGPT. And, you know, I'm having my kids write a paper on who was the most effective president economically. And I give them a list of 12, and they have to, you know, link the policies with positive economic effects. We talk about what positive economic effects are, like low inflation, low unemployment, so forth. And, yeah, I've been worried, you know.
Best dad ever.
Yeah, it is. And, but I've been, you know, worried about, you know, how does this ChatGPT, and all of us teachers are a little bit worried about how that's going to affect it. So I had, you know, I've been playing with ChatGPT myself, and it's kind of juvenile, the arguments that it makes against you. You can out-argue it, you know, really well, I mean, if you know what you're talking about. But I think that might be a good use for kids, is let them argue against ChatGPT instead of worrying so much about whether the ChatGPT can write them the essay. Because the essays that ChatGPT writes on the topics that I've talked about are rather limited. in my opinion. I don't think they're that, you know, profound. But have the kids argue against it, because that's what they need to develop, is the ability to think on their feet and to be able to respond, and have them print out, perhaps, I'm just spitballing here, but have them, you know, ask a question, ChatGPT responds, then they go and they respond back and pick apart its arguments and then keep going with it. That's, I think, a real way that kids could really use the ChatGPT and some of this technology to improve their actual minds themselves, so that they could learn how to argue and learn how to understand things. So yeah. Anyway, I just want to give that thought today.
Okay.
Wow. Listen, good thought. Look at data of the year right there, huh?
That's a good thought. Anything to sharpen the intellectual skills, I agree with that. The concern is that I don't have to think, because ChatGPT is going to think for me.
Right.
Or Bard, the Google bot, and so and all the other ones coming online. Fran and Aurora.
Yeah, I listened to the entire hearing yesterday, and I think there's a real concern about security. People need to go to other platforms that are U.S.-based, and they're out there. Parents, it's a nice thought that parents need to police this with their kids, but let's be realistic. I don't think they are. They don't look at their own security on their phones and iPads and computers, and they certainly don't take the time to look at what their kids are looking at. So in having listened to the entire hearing, I think it's a huge problem. You've got military kids who've got this on their phone. It's just not a good idea. And there are U.S.-based platforms, Instagram, there are other things. And people will move to those if TikTok gets banned.
Thanks for the call, Fran. Greg Schomburg.
Hey, Dan and Amy. Just two quick things. The point about the astronaut versus the influencer in terms of kids in the future, the way you can prove that on any given weekend or weekday, just walk through the Schomburg Library or any library and see the kids that are there. It is all of the Chinese
porn addicts.
Kids, all the Indian, excuse me?
Porn addicts mainly? Because isn't that what the libraries feature mainly these days, porn? Porn for the kids?
No. Not these kids. Dan, they're serious. They got kids that are putting their kids in Kumon, and they're running rings around us. I mean, seriously.
Oh, yeah,
and
are.
Then last but not least, as it relates to your IP addresses and the ability to track things, that can be done on any platform. So that issue or that dimension of this is really moot in my view. The issue mm-hmm. is really the critical nature of should we be putting up boundaries given the nature of technology, and what should that consist of to shield our national interest? And I think there's a powerful case for that, given the psychological dimensions that people have talked about.
Powerful case for what choice there? I mean, I think that's the right framework, but powerful case in what direction do you think?
Well, kids are very impressionable. And as much as I hate to involve government or something, there has to be something to protect these kids, because parents are working too much because they have to pay taxes. They're just so stressed out, they don't have time to get involved in that. And that's just the case. It's just accurate.
All right. Thanks for the call, Greg. Cindy Joliet. Hi, Cindy.
Cindy, are you there?
Hi. Yeah, I am. Sorry. Hi, Amy. Hi, Dan. I'm an educator, and I was going over some progress mapping for a student, and the reading scores were horrible. And the mom sat at the meeting and said, "Oh, we don't read in our family. We just talk to Siri and Google, and they tell us everything." I said, "Well, you know, that's not going to work when your son has to figure out how to fill out a job application." "Yeah, we'll cross that bridge when we come to it." So, you know, technology's really been bad for a lot of reasons, good for a lot of reasons. But I think the technological aspect of it, because as one of your callers said, the lack of involvement with parents. I look at our middle school, the kids are glued to to their phones. The minute the bell rings, the phones come out. And it drives me out of my mind. Because when you try to talk to them, it's like trying to talk to a store mannequin at Target. They no skills. So anyway, have a good weekend.
Thanks for the call, Cindy. Bob, Edison Park.
Yeah, my issue with this, and maybe I'm missing something in the whole conversation, is for the press and the media and the Republicans and the Democrats, they're all saying, basically, we're about to go to war with the Chinese. Okay, China is the biggest enemy we have in the minds of many American people in positions of power. Why, if that's the case, that China is such a threat, do we allow them to have such a dominant media control? I mean, if TikTok were owned by Russia at this point, or Iran or North Korea, I don't think this would even be a conversation. I don't know what the special relationship with China is. And I think my opinion is that the globalist corporatists are owned by the Chinese or vice versa. So China gets a special pass in all this. And Dan, I totally agree with you. Government interference scares me. Okay, and it's scary, but China is a different animal. I mean, China has basically, in their own newspaper, said they want to take over the United States, and pretty much they have, from farmland to business to media to Disney to Nike. So I agree that TikTok has to be banned, and the Chinese have to be given a different status until they completely change.
Well, thanks for the call, Bob. I mean, the special relationship is how economically intertwined we are with the country of China.
Right.
And you know, they get to play too, which is something that we seem to forget sometimes. And so if regulators here at Department of Justice force the sale of TikTok or ban TikTok outright, banned in the country, not just state governments banning it on state phones and municipal governments on municipal phones.
Just ban outright.
Banned it outright. Well, the Chinese can retaliate. They can kick companies, American companies, out of China, like GM and Microsoft and Boeing and Nike
Apple.
And Coca-Cola and Apple. Right. And
they would do that?
What do you think that does to the prices and thus the quality of life in this country? You know, because we're so economically intertwined, to through government fiat undo those interconnections will be costly to both sides. And then it becomes a question of what prices are we willing to pay, literally and figuratively, literally and from a national security perspective. It's just more complicated than banning or forcing a sale of TikTok.
Sports and politics and sports and politics and sports and politics and
intersection.
Arrogance and ignorance. Arrogance, ignorance, and arrogance and ignorance.
Intersection.
Dan and Amy, U.S. cyclocross champion Hannah Arensman said she's leaving the sport after finishing fourth between transgender quote-unquote women, despite her 35 championship wins in cyclocross. So she's apparently an accomplished cyclocross athlete.
She's well-known in the industry.
You're into cyclocross?
Dan, I do things you don't even know.
What is cyclocross?
What is cyclocross?
Oh, or you cycling? Don't even know what the word is.
I thought you were talking about cycling. I thought
you just said
it.
Hannah Arensman is well known in the industry.
Googled her and she's. Oh. I did a Don Lemon. I can Don Lemon too, you know.
Right. Told me she was well known.
Wow.
Thank you, George.
Cyclocross. Apparently, I don't know. I mean, just from the picture, it looks like basically like you ride a 10 speed on a BMX track.
Yeah.
Okay.
And you drive through mud and go up hills and, you know.
I could probably still
like
beat her.
Like a tough mudder contest, but on a bike.
I could probably still beat her with my Diamondback from back when I was a kid.
No, she'd spank you.
35 championship wins. She's only 25 years old. This is something that was filed on her behalf as a brief in a case in West Virginia, because the West Virginia Save Women's Sports Law is being challenged by the identitarian left, saying it's a violation of Title IX. She joined 66 other athletes in calling on the Supreme Court in the state of, on the United States Supreme Court, per this West Virginia case, to vacate the injunctions and to rule that West Virginia's law is constitutional. She said she retired from her sport in December because of the invasion of trans, quote unquote, women, meaning men, into the sport of cycling. As I mentioned at the outset, she recently came in the, one of her last races, I guess, came in fourth place. There was a man in third place and a man in fifth place. She wrote in this brief, I was born into a family of athletes, encouraged by my parents and siblings. I competed in sports from a young age, and I followed in my sister's footsteps, climbing the ranks to become an elite cyclocross racer. Over the past few years, I've had to race directly with male cyclists in women's events. As this has become more of a reality, it's become increasingly discouraging to train as hard as I do, only to have to lose to a man with the unfair advantage of an androgenized body that intrinsically gives him an obvious advantage over me, no matter how hard I train. I've decided to end my cycling career. In my last race at the UCI Cyclocross Championships in the elite women's category in December, I came in fourth place, flanked on either side by male riders, awarded third and fifth places. My sister and family sobbed as they watched a man finish in front of me, having witnessed several physical interactions with him throughout the race. Additionally, it's difficult for me to think about the very real possibility I was overlooked for an international selection on the U.S. team at Cyclocross Worlds in February of this year because of a male competitor. I feel for young girls learning to compete and are growing up in a day when they no longer have a fair chance at being the new world record holders and champions in cycling because men want to compete in our division. I felt deeply angered, disappointed, overlooked, and humiliated that the rulemakers of women's sports do not feel it necessary to protect women's sports to ensure fair competition for women anymore. Hannah Ahrensman. 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro, answer line 64636-DA, turnkey.pro, text line. I know we visited this topic before. In fact, we were well ahead of the learning curve on it years and years ago when we predicted what has come to pass, would come to pass, and it's only going to become more ubiquitous as we go. I mean, you know, there is some pushback, as Mike Scott reported. There was a...
The black box, you mean?
They're track organizers in field and track. World Athletics banned men, trans women, from competing in elite female competitions if they have gone through male puberty. They said yesterday men who've gone through puberty will be banned from participating in women's events based on the overarching need to protect the female category. Well, which is exactly what Hannah Ahrensman is talking about when it comes to cycling. Right. So now
we should make a third category, men, women, trans.
Well, how does that work?
That means that if you're a trans, you cannot compete for the men or the women. You have to have your own category. But there's got to be enough participants, and right now there's not enough participants in it. So, I mean, I don't know how widespread this is going to end up being.
What is the point of a third category? And if people say that, and they don't think through it.
I'm
that
trying
makes
to
no
think
sense.
Through it.
How does that make sense? So you have women pretending to be men competing with men pretending to be women. How's that going to be any different?
You're right. Yeah, I mean, I'm just trying to have a level playing field.
Yeah, here's the level playing field. There's two sexes, men and women, and they compete against each other respectively. You know, we've been doing this for a while.
Oh, yeah.
So,
and women never, you know, there was a time women didn't even have sports. When my mom was growing up in high school, which she went to high school and graduated with your dad, by the way, Larry, they had synchronized swimming, and then her senior year, they had intramural basketball. So, I mean, it's not, you know, as if women have been playing sports since the beginning of time. We had a fight to get sports for women. And now it's under attack again by the trans community.
Richard Dawkins, evolutionary biologist, famed atheist, God delusion, if you're familiar with Dawkins's work. He sat down for an interview with Piers Morgan talking about this in part because he's been... even though he's an atheist, right? Oh, it's just you radical Christians. It's the religious right. That's really evolutionary biologist and famed atheist Richard Dawkins on this topic, because he has been hit for not folding in the same way that J.K. Rowling and other prominent men and women of the left have been hit for not folding in.
It's bullying. And we've seen the way J.K. Rowling has been bullied, Kathleen Stock has been bullied. They've stood up to it. But it's very upsetting the way this tiny minority of people has managed to capture the discourse and to really talk arrant nonsense.
What's the answer to it?
Science. I mean, there are two sexes. You can talk about gender if you wish, and that's a subjective.
When people say there are 100 genders, for example.
I'm not interested in that. As a biologist, there are two sexes, and that's all there is to it.
There's one thing you can agree with Richard Dawkins about. I can.
I'll just never forget. Before the pandemic hit, I was in Tucson at a cycling class on, you know, LA Fitness on Oracle Road there, and I was spinning next to a man who was the Canadian cycling coach, because they go to, you know, Southern Arizona to train, you know, during the winter, because obviously you can't train. And he said he's having a problem because he has to find transgender. I go, what do you? This is the first time I had heard of it. And I said, what are you talking about? And he said, well, we can't compete because transgender men are now joining women's cycling. And we need to find transgender men so that we can compete against other countries. And that was the first time I went, what? And he didn't like the idea, but he said, you know, he's a coach, so he's got to, you know, win. And he said he's looking for a trans cycler.
The comments from Richard Dawkins, who's an evolutionary biologist by training, as I mentioned, very similar to, reminded me of the survey work that Steve Jacobs, who's was at Illinois Right to Life, did. He surveyed something like 5,000 biologists across the world, in academic settings, research settings. Simple question. When does life begin? 96% said at fertilization, because that's when life begins.
Wow.
Well, they're biologists, so right. they start with what they know to be true, because otherwise their entire career is a fraud. The same thing with Dawkins. We could argue about the existence of God, but he starts with what he knows as an evolutionary biologist. They start with what they know about the formation of life as biologists, 96%. And then they all are corrupted by politics. Oh, but I'm a leftist and I'm pro-abortion. When does life begin? Fertilization. Really? So what does that mean about the political position you've taken versus the scientific understanding you have? This is the divorce between reason and politics, between reason and sentiment. And it leads to all sorts of barbarism, like forcing Hannah Arendsman out of a sport that she's been a champion in at 25. Ralph and Rantoul, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. So let's follow the crazy logic to the logical conclusion, or maybe far off, right? They should immediately reinstate Lance Armstrong and his 7 Tour de France jerseys, because if a guy can pretend to be a girl and ride a bike in a race, then why can't a guy also use the testosterone from like 10,000 testicles on his bicycle when he rides in a race? Because you couldn't do that for real, because it would make bike riding impossible.
Thanks for the call, Ralph. Well, or you could throw a wig on him and send him up to Canada to that coach that's looking for a trans female bicyclists. Yeah. Tony Southside.
Hey, what's going on here? So what is this sport called again? I forgot.
Cyclocross, Tony. It's the sport of the future. It's going to replace pickleball.
Yeah, no, I don't think so, because if the common man like me doesn't know about it, then when they start losing their top athletes, it's going to fall off the face of the earth. That's all I got to say.
Yeah, it's a good point. Thanks for the call.
No, they just drive through. It's like Tough Mudder. If you've ever, Mike Scott did a Tough Mudder contest. You just run through the mud and go over obstacles. It's the same thing.
It's motocross, but you're on a bicycle, not
you're on
motorcycle.
A mountain bike, you know.
Yeah.
Well, kind of.
You know what my feeling is about bicycling.
Oh, my God, you hate cyclists.
I'm against it. That's right.
You hate
maybe not on a night. Maybe not on a
and spandex.
Maybe not on a, like a BMX track or a motocross track, but on the streets.
If you could, you would drive your car down Lakeshore Drive on the bike path. Get rid of.
Well, I'm not going to hurt anybody, but I will imprison them.
Is it the outfits that bothers you so much, or the fact that they think they own the roads?
The whole culture.
Yeah, it is a subculture.
The whole culture is just, there's nothing redeeming about it.
I was in it for a while. I have one of those road warrior outfits, Dan.
Yeah, that does not surprise me.
Well, I did a few hundred mile rides, and I ride. I used to do triathlons.
I don't, what is the point of that?
I don't think
it's the same thing as jogging. I don't know. Like, I'm going to go nowhere. I'm going to take a lot of time to go nowhere for no particular reason.
It's called running, not jogging.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, right. What I see out there is somewhere between walking and jogging. I don't see a lot of Usain Bolts, you know, meandering around the neighborhoods. Matt in Southside.
Good morning, Dan. Good morning, Amy. I just wanted to point out that a lot of these young female athletes that are complaining now are, I feel, a lot of the liberal ones that, you know, are either in college or went to college. And I do find it kind of funny and interesting. I feel like maybe this is coming home to roost. Now, on the other side of that, I do feel bad because I understand it's not all young women who feel this way. But my only hope now is that maybe the more young ladies that this starts to affect, the more we'll start to see change. And that's all I got to say about that. Thank you. Have a good weekend.
Thanks for coming out. Definitely it's a hoist by your own Title IX petard, isn't it? That definitely is it for you. Second and third wave feminists. Yep, that you bought completely into identitarianism. You bought completely into counting by non-behavioral characteristics like sex. And now somebody else has taken up that same angle and you're the one on the outs. Which is why, here we go, class, a little lesson. Yes. You want to confer benefits and impose responsibilities based on non-behavioral characteristics like race and sex. Well, good luck. You're going to enjoy it when you're the beneficiary of the benefits. You're not going to enjoy it so much when there are burdens imposed on you to provide the benefits. And that's how it goes. Sometimes you're in favor and sometimes you're not. It's a terrible way to organize a free society. Jeff in Cal City.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. You know, it's just going to take a very short while for a guy to say, forget about all this trans stuff. All he has to do is just say, I identify. He doesn't have to wear a wig or put on makeup or lipstick or wear high heels or anything. All you have to do is just say, I'm a woman and I'm going to compete against them. That's it.
Yeah, well, right. Well, that's what's happening. I mean, what's happening in the pool at Penn? Right? With
that,
the clownfish?
That woke a lot of lefties up, I got to tell you. People who were, oh, it's okay, you know, just this one time we can let it trans. But Leah Thomas?
I
changed a lot of people's minds.
I didn't see him having his hair did and wearing all kinds of jewelry in the pool or pre or post.
He still has his junk.
He's just a guy.
I think you have to cut it off. I'm like, if you're going to be a woman, go all in. I mean, don't just half, you know, blanket.
But I mean, what Jeff is saying, the clownfish, quote unquote, Leah Thomas, he just puts on like a, you know, Curly from the Three Stooges bathing suit and he just jumps in the pool. It's just a dude in the pool with the women. He's 6'4".
Six freaking four. And he's a man. He's stronger. He's more muscle. He's got it all. He could
compete. So we saw. No, he's got it all for the women's game. Will and Skokie.
Hey, we got to remember, gender is not a matter of biology or sex. Gender is a matter of grammar. That's it. They take something that fits their agenda. They change the word definition, and they think they won. And as your previous or somebody previous on here said, I think it was Dawkins, you've got way less than 1% of the people trying to change the entire society. Where do they get off? We just have to sit there and laugh at them.
That's wow. the thing. Ridicule is great.
Yeah, right, well, thanks for the call. Well, yeah, but I mean, Dawkins is sort of perplexed at how they've been able to do what they've been able to do. And we laugh and they advance. So who's getting the last laugh here exactly? Dan and Amy, Chicago's Morning Answer.
I want to be a woman. From now on, I want you all to call me Loretta.
What?
It's my right as a man.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. From a secular perspective, you know why I'm against the death penalty?
Why? Because you've always been against it. Oh, no. Yeah. You know, and I'm for capital punishment. Bring it.
Because of the competency or the lack thereof of the state.
Oh, well.
Why I'm against it. Let me give you a couple of examples of what I'm talking about. This is a nominee to the federal district court in Colorado, a Biden nominee. His name is Cato Cruz, and Senator John Kennedy from Louisiana, did it to another Biden nominee unprepared for a committee hearing on his candidacy, his nomination. Cato Cruz queried by Senator John Kennedy about his knowledge of the law, you know, federal district court judge. Mm-hmm. And I won't reveal it at the outset, but the question that Senator Kennedy asks is something that a federal district court judge should know. This is not an esoteric reference that Kennedy makes in the question.
Tell me how you analyze a Brady motion.
How I analyze a Brady motion?
Yes.
Senator, in my 4.5 years on the bench, I don't believe I've had the occasion to address a Brady motion in my career.
Do you know what a Brady motion is?
Senator, in my time on the bench, I've not had occasion to address that, and so it's not coming to mind at the moment what a Brady motion is.
Do you recall the U.S. Supreme Court case, Brady v. Maryland?
I do recall the name of the case, the Senator, yes.
And what did it hold?
I believe that the Brady case the Brady case involves something regarding the Second Amendment. It is not. I have not had occasion to address that. If that issue were to come before me, I would certainly analyze that Supreme Court precedent and apply it as I would need to the facts in front of me.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Not only does Brady v. Maryland have nothing to do with the Second Amendment, it's clear that he was searching for an answer. He thinks Brady. I wonder if that has something to do with Sarah Brady and Jim Brady and gun control.
Right.
Brady v. Maryland was decided 60 years ago.
Ooh.
And by the way, it's something that anybody who goes through law school and takes a criminal law course like I did would be exposed to. And it's kind of important because it set the precedent that the prosecution is required to turn over exculpatory evidence to the defense. That's kind of a big thing in criminal law, not an esoteric thing. And so when you have judges like that on benches at state court, federal court, not to mention lawyers in public defender's offices who about have the same handle on the law and vigorous representation of their clients as Judge Cruz does. Yeah, I get a little jumpy when the state is in the position of deciding who lives and who dies. And by the way, I mean, just as a refresher, I say John Kennedy did it again because just a few weeks ago, we played it for you here, John Kennedy, senator from Louisiana, mm-hmm. asked questions of another Joe Biden federal district court nominee, Charnel Jekyllgren. These are also not esoteric questions, as should be readily recognizable to you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and congratulations to all of you. Judge, on the far end, tell me what Article 5 of the Constitution does.
Article 5 is not coming to mind at the moment.
Okay. How about Article 2?
Of the Constitution?
Neither is Article 2.
Okay. Do you know what purposivism is?
If you didn't know what Article 5 and Article 2 was, good luck.
In my 12 years as an assistant attorney general and my 9 years serving as a judge, I was not faced with that precise question. We are the highest trial court in Washington State, so I'm frequently faced with issues that I'm not familiar
with.
Look what
I
and
have
I thoroughly
done.
Review the law, our research, and apply the law to the facts presented to me.
Wonderful. And one of these days, I'm going to get around to reading the United States Constitution. I'm only a trial court judge in the highest court in Washington State.
Oh,
Article 2?
Bad.
Article 2 is the executive branch. Article 5? Article 5 is amending the Constitution. Purposivism? I mean, it doesn't sound as high-minded as it is. It's not as high-minded as it sounds with the word purposivism. It just means interpreting legislation based on the legislative intent, the purpose of the legislation, thus purposivism. But these experienced judges, hey, but I don't know anything, but when something is presented to me, I thoroughly investigate. I mean, base of knowledge is a requirement, it should be, for positions like this, sitting in judgment of people.
This is bad.
And so now think about imposing the ultimate punishment and tell me that you're completely comfortable with what you see, and particularly in our hyper-politicized times, in prosecutors' offices, in public defenders' offices, on the bench. Not me. For more on this, because there's a case out of Texas that speaks to my point, I think. We're pleased to be joined by Dr. Sally Satel, who's a psychiatrist and senior fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. Dr. Satel, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
So tell us about this case out of Texas. And I got some real questions about how it got to this point. But the case of Andre Lee Thomas, who is a death row inmate in Texas and scheduled to be executed.
Yeah, this is a terrible story. And I suppose I should warn that some details of this crime are pretty gruesome.
We can
take
we'll
it. Go into. Okay. So this Andre Lee Thomas, now he's 39, but he's been on death row since 2004 for a crime, as I said, quite awful. But he was someone with paranoid schizophrenia, which means he was subject to delusions. And in his case, he believed sincerely that his ex-wife was Jezebel, that two of his children were possessed by the devil. And so he attacked them, actually cut out their hearts, and put them in his pocket, and then stabbed himself in the chest, intending to die. But he didn't. He survived, and he went to the police. And he admitted what he did and asked whether he'd be forgiven. He told the police that he thought this was the will of God, and kept wondering if his family was really dead. So obviously this is the product of a deranged mind, not a callous, hardcore, standard criminal. And when he was in jail, he was reading the Bible and came across this famous verse, Matthew 5:29, which says, if your right eye causes you to sin, gouge it out and throw it away. And that's what he did. So he blinded himself. He went on trial about a year later. He was considered to be competent to stand trial because he was very psychotic at the time, and a person cannot go to trial until they've become competent, meaning that they understand the charges against them and can cooperate with the counsel. So it took about a year, and obviously he needed significant medical attention for blinding himself, and with psychiatric medication he could participate. His lawyers asked for not guilty by reason of insanity, which sounds like a very reasonable defense, but because he had possibly taken several pills of cold medicine before the crime, the prosecutor successfully argued that really his murders were the product of drug effects and not a primarily, you know, psychotic mind. And so he went on death row. And this is one more awful detail. He was psychotic on death row, still on medication, but not responding well. And at one point, several years later, I think 2008, he thought that the government was reading his thoughts and doing that through his remaining eyeball. So that was removed by him. So now we have a blind man who's psychotic and was scheduled to be executed on April 5th. His lawyers, about 2 weeks ago, were able to convince the Board of Pardons and the governor to stay the execution. They originally asked just for it to be commuted so he would spend the rest of his life in prison. But at the very least, they said, can we have more time to demonstrate that he is not competent to be executed? There was a Supreme Court ruling in 2007 which said that it is a violation of the Eighth Amendment, that's cruel and unusual punishment, to execute someone who doesn't know he's being executed, or maybe does know he's being executed, but has a fanciful understanding of why that's happened. And in fact, the case is called Panetti and Quarterman, and the defendant thought that he knew he was being executed, Mr. Panetti, but he thought it was because the state didn't want him to preach the gospel, not because he had killed people. So that's where we are now. His lawyers are collecting data, getting psychiatric exams to try to make the case that Mr. Thomas, is not competent, that he doesn't really understand why he is scheduled to be executed. And if they succeed, they will either push his execution date further back, or they will just commute his sentence. I can't imagine how they could think he could ever become competent. So, yeah.
How did this case not get pled out? I mean, how did it get to the point where it actually went to trial and he was convicted, right? And then the death sentence was imposed? He obviously did it. He admitted he did it.
He put their heart in his pocket.
How does defense counsel not go and say, okay, take the death penalty off the table and then let's argue about either life in prison or life at a psychiatric institution until he's deemed fit to be released?
Well, now it sounds like you are a lawyer, right? Well, I'm not, so I don't know that the details in great depth, except to say that, I mean, their attempt at doing that was to have a not guilty, you know, by reason of insanity defense. And there, this case is complicated further by having, there was questions about whether the jury was racist. Andrew Lee Thomas is black. The woman he killed, his wife, his ex-wife, was white. And during the jury, the voir dire, there were people who were selected, but who had very critical things to say about intermarriage. And in fact, this was brought, this as a Sixth Amendment issue, in other words, quality, you know, of fair counsel, was just brought to the Supreme Court a few months ago to try to basically vacate the situation because his trial was basically unconstitutional because of these jurors. And the Supreme Court did not honor that, although the three liberal justices actually published a dissent, which I gather is a bit unusual. Often they just say they're not going to deal with it, but they felt strongly about it. Justice Kagan and Mayor and why am I blocking on the other liberal justice? Oh, the new
KBJ.
Yeah.
Ketanji Brown Jackson. As I read from your piece over at National Review, there were different psychiatric evaluations presented at trial. One believed him not to be competent to stand trial, and the other believed that it was a matter of impulse control, but that he understood the difference between right and wrong.
And it gets worse. One of the psychiatrists who examined him, I just find this so unbelievable, thought he was malingering. In other words, thought he was exaggerating his problems by blinding himself, which is just mind-boggling. But yeah, there were questions also whether he was competent to stand trial at all. You know, whether he was really below the threshold of completely understanding the charges against him and ability to cooperate. So that was a question. But I don't want to sound cynical, but this is a town called Sherman, Texas, which I gather is, you know, just a very traditional, you know, punitive oriented when it comes to these kinds of cases. And also, again, these are just details that have nothing to do with the larger point. The larger point being, why are we even executing people with severe mental illness? But apparently the main lawyer was kind of sick and not doing a very good job. And
yeah, here we go.
There we go.
The competency of counsel. But I mean, so yeah, I mean, you can be punitive because the crimes are so horrific. People say, well, that person needs to be executed. I can understand that visceral reaction. But then you get the full context, and maybe a lot of people haven't.
Of course.
And then you say, well, wait a second. And then you look at Supreme Court precedent on the topic, and there's a couple of cases that seem to me relevant to this discussion. And you say, well, wait a second. And then hopefully Greg Abbott, the governor there, will say, as you said, he stated, will say, wait a second, too, and commute it to life and then hash it out whether he belongs in prison or a facility. But I mean, this is a good case of sort of what I was talking about at the outset, where, you know, just be careful how much absolute trust you put in absolute authority, because there are just cases that you can't imagine. And there are performances from quote unquote professionals that you also can't imagine. And when the can't imagines come together, then something you can't imagine can happen that you'll regret.
Yeah. I'd like to say something that's a little optimistic here.
Okay.
I happen to believe that, I mean, who knows, but I happen to believe they will commute his sentence. There's a lot of people have written letters and bishops,
yeah,
and he's gotten a lot of sympathy. For 2 points. Well, first is that in 2002, the Supreme Court did decide that people with intellectual disability, and they, at the time the term was mental retardation, should not be held.
Atkins decision.
Yes, the Atkins decision, right, that if your IQ was below 70, that wasn't in the decision per se, but that's typically how it plays out. If an IQ is below a certain threshold, then a person would not be eligible for the death penalty. Doesn't mean they won't be punished, and they may well get life in prison, but they won't get the death penalty. So that is a bit of a precedent when it comes to the idea that, you know, if you're not rational in the case of severe mental illness, you know, then your moral reasoning is defective. And if your moral reasoning is defective, then you can't be blameworthy in the way most people are. And then your punishment has to be different. And the second thing I just wanted to mention is that a number of states, Ohio leading the pack in 2021, passed a law with strong bipartisan support that exempted people with severe mental illness who were psychotic at the time of the crime. Now, that's very important. Were psychotic at the time of the crime, like Mr. Thomas, you know, believed just delusional ideas about his family, that they could not be executed. And it's retroactive. So if there are people on death row now who were psychotic at the time of the crime but didn't meet that very, very high bar for not guilty by reason of insanity, which is a very high bar, and some people don't meet it. Some people have poor representation in the case of Mr. Thomas, I think it's fair to say. But that's an excellent law. And Kentucky passed one the year later. Unfortunately, it's not retroactive, but it's something. And Texas is even considering one, and a few more states. So, and then if a case comes before the Supreme Court that's relevant, they should, in my opinion, consider this also a violation of the Eighth Amendment, as they did for executing people who are mentally retarded. And that would be a good outcome.
Well, again, I think Governor Abbott's a pretty decent guy. So to the extent that he gets the full picture here, hopefully he does the right thing, as you suggest optimistically. She is Dr. Sally Satel, psychiatrist and senior fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. Dr. Satel, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. And she joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Boy, ever since Steve Jobs' widow bought The Atlantic, the outlet should come with a laugh track.
Why?
this piece.
I'll laugh for you.
What really broke the banks? What really broke the banks? The Fed, among others, is blameworthy, but the ultimate culprit is? Fill in the blank. The ultimate culprit? The ultimate culprit of all things for the last 3 years, the ultimate culprit? COVID. COVID broke the banks. You see, what happened is first the earth cooled and then the dinosaurs came, yeah. But they got too big and fat, so they all died and they turned into oil. And then the Arabs came and they bought Mercedes-Benzes, and mm-hmm. Princess Charles started wearing all of Lady Di's clothes. Couldn't believe it. He took her best summer dress, put it on, and went to town. Oh, wait, that's Jacobs from Airplane, but it's about the same line of argumentation from The Atlantic. After COVID-19 hit the U.S., U.S. bank deposits soared by themselves. The pandemic relief measures, including stimulus payments, expanded unemployment insurance, paycheck protection program funds, put more money in people's hands, even as consumer spending fell. At the same time, businesses cut back sharply on spending and investment. You mean when they were closed? The result was a flood of money into the banking system, and then so on and so forth. You get to being on the wrong side of bond holdings. That's what's happened to the banks. It's COVID. Not anything we did in response to COVID. It just traces right from the dinosaurs to Prince Charles and Princess Di's clothes. For more on this, we're pleased to be joined by the capitalist pig, Jonathan Honig. He is also the author of new textbook of Americanism, The Politics of Ayn Rand. Jonathan, thanks for joining us. Oh, and by the way, thanks for that capitalist pig T-shirt you sent us.
Oh, yeah.
Well, you know,
yeah.
You're one of the few, you and Amy are one of the few brave enough to wear it these days, Dan and Amy. Great to be with you. Yeah, but capitalism is a bad word. And I'll tell you, capitalism is not what we see in the banking sector. Let's not kid ourselves that, you know, this is some type of situation where greedy capitalists have gone awry. As you're alluding to, I mean, government has been at the center of this banking crisis, creating the spending, creating the stimulus that created the deposits and the liquidity that now banks and individuals are dealing with in terms of inflation and upside down investment.
Yeah, the whole story that's being told with respect to everything, it can be commercial real estate, commercial, you know, rents, commercial real estate values. It could be children's educational performance. It can be anything under the sun. And the virus did this all to us because, of course, the policy choices that were made by the Fed, as well as the federal government and state and local governments, too, those are the only choices to be made. And that just needs to be challenged at every turn.
Absolutely, Dan and Amy. I mean, both sides of the aisle agree now. If you ask them that all the spending, all the stimulus during COVID, the paycheck protection program that we know out was rife with fraud, the ultra low interest rates, people accept that that was needed to somehow stave off, help us during the pandemic. But of course, we're paying for it now. And you've got a majority of Americans, Dan and Amy, even those making $100,000 a year, saying that they're literally having trouble making ends meet, addressing the daily needs and their family's daily needs. So, you know, this is not over yet. In fact, I think the banking contagion isn't over yet. You're likely to see some more banks probably as early as this weekend come under government control.
Wait, well, what do you mean? Like how many?
Yeah, how expansive do you think it is?
Well, look, there's been estimates done in the last 2 weeks that say you could have as many as 200 banks in the very much the same situation as a Silvergate and Signature, and that very long-dated assets and the SVB as well. Very long-dated assets and very unsticky deposits. So if there's a bank run, and we've seen that. A lot of banks fail. Even this morning, Dan and Amy, rumors about Deutsche Bank, which is one of the 30 biggest banks in the world and in the Europe under some pressure. So, you know, I'm not a Cassandra, but I think now is an especially good time to make sure you don't have more than $250,000 in any one bank.
Unless you're with one of the big boys that's government backed by Janet Yellen, or one of the small boys that's also government backed, maybe, according to Janet Yellen. We don't know.
Yeah, I think that's part of what's so uncertain and kind of what reminds me very much of 2008. Again, not to be a Cassandra, Dan and Amy, but you remember back then, you know, government stepped in to facilitate a bailout of Bear Stearns and of AIG and of Citigroup, but not of Lehman Brothers.
No, Lehman, so, right.
So yep. Even as you're, you know, suggesting that uncertainty about just what the, again, I mean, if this was any other industry, entertainment, transportation, there wouldn't be the systemic risk. But because government is so involved in the banking system, it's almost a really a private-public partnership. Everyone's waiting not to see what happens with the economy, but what happens with Janet Yellen and government in D.C.
So when you talk about, you know, that the one projection, a couple hundred banks, I mean, a couple hundred banks out of more than 4,000 that are FDIC insured doesn't necessarily rock the system. Although if it's a lot of big banks, the Credit Suisses and the Deutsche Bank, then it starts to get a little bit more interesting along with Silicon Valley. Is your expectation, is it your belief that the main potential contagion is balance sheets that are similar to Silicon Valley with their devalued bond positions, or is it something else?
Well, you know, I wish I could tell, Dan. I mean, we've been in this game, for over 20 years, and each time it's a little different. If, in fact, this is that type of a banking crisis. I just remind you, back in 2008, people thought it was, in effect, subprime loans. Remember, it was first seen as a subprime problem. Then ultimately, over the course of a very ugly summer of 2008, it metastasized into what we now know as the global financial crisis. So, you know, all we know is that banks are under pressure. You know, Bank of America had a new 52-week low just yesterday. So, again, not a Cassandra. I would never bet against this great country. But, you know, when Janet Yellen and the government tells us that don't worry about the banks, we've got it under control, the market seems more worried than they would have us believe.
And your reaction to the decision by Powell this week to kick rates up a quarter point?
Yeah, well, you know, central planners are always wrong. They can't be right. So, you know, it's just as their ultra low interest rates created the inflation and, you know, spurred the spending and the malinvestment. Now, the higher than average interest rates could really crash and slow the economy. So, again, it's true that, you know, the Federal Reserve, and look, this country thrived without the Federal Reserve created in the early part of the 20th century. So, you know, they create the boom and bust cycles. And, you know, it's why so many of the clients I'm talking to at CapitalistPig.com simply want out now. You know, they're feeling tormented by the inflationary tumult and the volatility. So there's just a lot of fear. So much of it's being created not by the economy, but by the government, the inflation, and all the rest.
Where do they want to go? I mean, they want to take their money out they want to lower the risk associated with their money. Are they going to cash? Are they going to gold? Where are they going?
Well, I mean, and again, this is sounds like a, you know, it's an infomercial, Dan, but, you know, gold is really one of the shining investments right now. No question. Up about $2,000 announced yesterday, not too far from it. It's all-time high. That tends to be an indication that momentum is set to continue. I mean, and it's not surprising. I mean, at the time you're seeing major banks, those even with that federal backing and backstop, down 10, 15, 20% in just a year, and worries about a potential weakness in the U.S. dollar. You know, this is a time that gold's really shining. I'll say this, don't make it an all or none. You know, where people always go wrong, Dan, is they, you know, whether it's Netflix or gold or even Beanie Babies, you know, they go hog wild. They put all the money to make it part of a portfolio, not your only part.
Yeah.
But this is certainly a time I think gold's going to shine.
Yeah, the only, you know, the Beanie Babies did well for Ty Warner, but I don't know about anybody else that put all their money in Beanie Babies. Yeah. That's why I got out of alpaca farms. I thought that better to diversify a little bit. Yeah, not put all my money in alpacas.
Too much for your condo.
Do you have a perspective on commercial real estate with the change, the ongoing change in the landscape away from brick and mortar, but particularly accelerated through COVID?
Yeah,
and the reaction to COVID.
From week to weaker, unfortunately. You know, we can't look at real estate, Dan and Amy, without ignoring not only interest rates, which, you know, is directly hurting the real estate market, but the bank system writ large. I mean, behind so many of these bank holdings are mortgage-backed securities. So we've seen actually a lot of the commercial real estate, even residential as well, weaken as the banking sector has weakened as well. So look, when we're talking about our own homes, maybe a piece of property, it's always location, location, location. And of course, real estate isn't something you can trade like a stock, but the signs for real estate, at least as evidenced by publicly traded REITs, is quite weak, Dan and Amy. So this is an area, I think if you're putting money to work, you've got to be very careful the bottom ain't in yet.
All right. He is the Capitalist Pig, Jonathan Honig, founder of the Capitalist Pig Hedge Fund and author of the book, A New Textbook of Americanism, The Politics of Ayn Rand. Capitalist Pig, Jonathan Honig, thanks as always.
Best to you both. Be well.
Thank you. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
You're listening to Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560. The Answer.
Open mic! Open mic Friday! Call it now! Open mic Friday!
Yes, it's that time of the week. 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line. Give us a call. We'll take your comments, compliments, concerns, compliments, general crack pottery. We'll take it all on this Open Mic Friday. Amy, anything you wanted to address before we went to the phone lines?
You know, this week, Kevin Fox died. And a lot of people in newsrooms across this Chicago had no idea who that person even was. And Kevin Fox was wrongly accused of killing Riley, his daughter. And he was exonerated. The police framed him. They thought, no, he did it, and didn't even look at other people at the time. And I just, it was not his fault. It was a sunny day at 4 o'clock on a Monday afternoon. And the other driver, this is in Arkansas because he remarried and moved down there. Other driver crossed the median and hit him head on. I just wanted to send my condolences to his family because they have been through so much. And the fact that he's gone is just really, it's shocking to a lot of people. So do you remember that story when it happened?
Well, I remember the Riley Fox story, sure.
Yeah, and I just...
That was back in a day when a kid was murdered. People actually paid attention.
Exactly.
And they were concerned about it.
And I was down there when people were searching frantically for her, and then they found the body, and it was just, that was like our life for months. And then he got arrested, and then he was exonerated. It was just, I was down in Wilmington all the time, and I just felt sick for his family because, again, they've been through so much, and he had his second chance at life. They had a settlement for $8 million. He, started his life over again, and then this happened. So just things can happen in an instant. So tell the people you love that you love them every time before you leave.
Do you have anything? My empathy is for Connor Murphy, Blackhawks defenseman.
Uh-huh.
He was all ready to wear his rainbow jersey for homosexual and lesbian night at the United Center on Sunday.
You mean LGBTQ Pride Day or whatever? Yes. Mm-hmm.
Whatever they call it. And it's not happening. The Hawks are scrapping plans to wear the rainbow homosexual and lesbian trans jerseys on Sunday night.
And the rainbow sticks.
He's really, really disappointed about it. Apparently, the Hawks are saying that they decided not to wear the jerseys this year over safety concerns for players with families in Russia, where a new law has banned supporting LGBTQ relationships.
Right. And if the loved ones do it back here in the States, they could be something could happen to their family members in Russia. Mm-hmm. So I agree with that. I mean, you got to protect your people first. Yeah. And again, this all started with wearing pink for breast cancer awareness. Once you let that in, then you let this all happens.
Yeah, no.
That's why I was against it. And I'm not against, go get your mammograms, lady. Do your part. But that was the beginning of them. Once that started, I'm like, now they're going to alter jerseys for social causes from now until the end of time.
And the next thing you know, the Iowa Hawkeyes have equality on the back of their jerseys.
You're damn right.
They don't even understand why. They don't understand what the word means.
Yep, you're right.
All right, let's go to the phone lines. John in Bridgeport, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Good morning, guys. All right, here's the man with they'll bring peace and goodwill and a good set of mind to all your audience there. Polls are coming out saying it's a dead heat between Vallis and whoever he's running against, that guy Johnson. I crunched the numbers here from the primary and everything. I got Vallis up 6 to 7 right now, and I believe media is trying to suppress this just to have a story to make it sound like a dogfight, but right now it's not. Oh. Just letting you know.
All right. Well, he was up 6%, okay, and now the latest poll has him up 2%.
Thanks for nothing.
I crunched the numbers. John in Bridgeport has him up 6% in his basement. Okay. Right. Yeah, brother. Ron, Southside.
Hey, Dan and Amy, really enjoyed that interview discussion about the death penalty. Majority of my life, I believed in it, and then eventually I changed my mind. So two things, Amy, I know you can't just change your mind on one particular case, but maybe another time you let me know that you think about it. But more importantly, the guy just mentioned Valis, and this is mainly for you, Amy. I am attending an event, a Valis event this evening. He'll be there, and if he buys me a beer, forget about it. I'm all
that's
in.
Right. Ron, go up to him and say, Amy told me that you should buy me a beer. I'm not kidding you.
Exactly.
Tell Paul, walk
and
up to Paul Valis and
bourbon,
say that.
And if he buys me a bourbon,
you vote twice.
I'll do door to door. Y'all have a great weekend.
All right, thanks.
We got a text message. The left has completely ruined all sports for me, Dan and Amy. Why can't they just play the game without virtue signaling? Good point.
Eduardo, Midway.
Yeah, that LA strike is over now, but they're gonna strike again. These kids have been off too much time since we had the COVID lockdowns. Ted Lasso was at the White House. He should have been talking about that.
Right. That we caused this. The situation about mental health was exacerbated because of
Jason Sudeikis should have been talking about it, or the government?
No, he was at the White House.
Yeah, didn't you see that? Ted Lasso was at the White House in the White House briefing room talking about mental health.
Who's Ted Lasso? Who's the actor?
Oh, Jason Sudeikis.
Well, that's what I just said.
Yeah.
So, Jason, you want Jason Sudeikis to talk about the LA school strike, but not the president?
All right, Eduardo.
It's so weird that
Sudeikis to solve the labor impasse between the teachers and the administration in L.A. What?
I mean, the White House cannot be taken seriously. They bring character actors on. Like, Jason Sudeikis himself personally didn't experience mental illness. His character did. And they bring him to the White House to talk about it. It's such a reach. They're such star chasers, just like Obama was.
Oh, Nelly. Don in Bloomingdale.
You know, guys, for years I petitioned the NFL to wear brown jerseys to acknowledge colon rectal cancer, but they never returned my phone call.
Yeah. It's got a great idea, Don. Way to go.
Heart disease kills more women than breast cancer, but no one wears red.
Mm-hmm.
They don't put red bands and red socks with their Bears uniforms. Oh, it's so cute. Everybody wearing pink. Ugh. Made me And then it trickled down to high school level, too.
At a Hawks game or Bears game, for that matter, how about cirrhosis awareness?
Yeah. Everybody's drunk now.
It's the only way to live there. Mary Kay in Western Springs.
Hi, guys. I want to talk about my school board candidates that I'm backing. Tim Block is running. I volunteer for him, walk with him personally. I like the guy. Big transparent learning, and he's out of that school, but he volunteers in that school, so he sees everything firsthand, what's going on in there. I support Tim Black. He's running, and this is not a slate, Dave Herndon, H-E-R-N-D-O-R, and Frank Evans.
You're three for three. Those are the three candidates.
Yep,
yes.
Good for you.
Yes, sir. Yes. Go to Black for a cap, solve Black for lpboard.com to get more information. Email
spell the name VLCEK. And Herndon and Evans. Right.
Herndon and Evans. All District 204. We got to get moving here, people. We have to. If you want to know more, you can contact me. My phone number is out there. You guys know me from Western Springs. I'd be happy to talk more about this.
Hey, whatever happened to the, whatever happened with the Heaven Washington case there at Lyons Township?
Yeah, I wrote to the patch and told them they really blew it. They didn't. I don't know what happened.
That's Nobody does.
Because they won't
Nobody
tell knows. Anybody.
Because she's black. We're never going to know.
Yes, buried.
No, thanks for the call, Mary Kay. Appreciate it.
Got a text message. School board recommendations. Beecher, 200. Todd Gregory. Melanie Brennenstahl. Susan Siewoninski. And Ashley Fletchling.
Okay. We'll revisit all these next week too. We'll run the list because we're compiling in real time. But I got one too.
Elections a week from Tuesday.
I might as well mention we're mentioning them. Wait, hold on. Okay,
we'll do it live.
Aaron Glenn for Stevenson 125. Aaron Glenn, Stevenson 125, up there, way north. But we'll put it all together. We'll run those again. Yeah. Solicit your recommendations as well next week.
Don't forget Blanca Kaufman, New Trier.
Mary, Midway.
Oh, hi. This ain't much, but I just wanted to mention I was disappointed when you were talking about Janulius earlier. I was thinking for sure you were going to play that clip of him, his acceptance speech when he was sobbing the whole speech. You know what? I mean, he probably was just, like, shocked by the insanity that he got reelected, to his credit, but I would like to give him something to cry about.
What did he get reelected? He got elected. He didn't get reelected.
Yeah. Oh, you're right. Thank you. But you should have played somebody dropped the ball. You should have played that clip of him crying.
Yeah.
Oh, when he won Secretary of State. No.
Yeah.
Man up. Okay, get a grip.
Just to restate for the record.
Please.
There is no more oleaginous non-entity in public office than Ali G. And it should be a badge of dishonor worn by the state of Illinois and the majority that elected that goof.
He's such a cool cat. He plays basketball with Obama. Yeah, he's
I mean, it's amazing. The family makes out by making loans to mobsters. The bank fails. They cash out. Taxpayers are on the hook for hundreds of millions of dollars, and he's some golden boy for the Democrat socialists in Illinois. Can you be any more lost than to be an Ali G supporter? Paul Vallis, by the way, endorsed by Ali G. Nation in Aurora.
Hey, how are you? Good morning. Well, I decided to grow up. I'm 71 years here. And I'm on my way to Grandparents' Day, but I wanted to throw this in for all of these climate changers. The climate was changed one time. God flooded the earth. He's going to change it again, and it will be
Naples. Global
warming, hotter than a fajita. Have a good day.
All right, Nation. Enjoy Grandparents' Day. Oh, we can't have any election talk without Ziff from Hyde Park weighing in.
Ziff.
Good morning to the greatest talk show team since, I think his name was Dave Baum.
I'm a modern day Dave Baum. Nobody knows who that is. But okay, go ahead. Thank you so much. I'll take that as a compliment.
Thank you. I'm a little nervous, but I watched Crimson Tide when Denzel and the two of them confronted each other, so you got to keep your senses.
Uh-huh.
But it's something we got to do because we can't blow this thing. Amy has worked too hard. We have to do something, Dan. I don't know what we can do. You know, I have a great idea. I need to get Paul to go right to the heart of the community. Get on the air. I'm not going to let nobody steal this from me either because I'm going to grab him for an hour. Get on the air when it's packed, and then I give my great speech and do a little Wizard of Oz music or something and say, Paul, here's these people, talk to them yourself. And right at the L, that we need something, Amy. Just, Amy, rest this weekend and next week. Tell us, what is it that we're going to have to do to drive it as Dan would do, to putt into the hole?
I wish the election was last week. If the election was last week, it would be over. But I'm bonding with my neighbors who are nervous,
Chicago,
too, about Paul.
Mm-hmm.
Talking
this
to people
is so,
ever in my life.
This election is so dramatic.
It is so many aspects to
this election. It is somebody. It is some. Now, here's what better not happen. One of them guys make a big goof right now. Say something like, well, if you don't believe me, you can follow me. Okay, yeah, and they did it, too. And you see what happened to his presidency. Something's got to. Maybe Dan can. Well, Dan's on the golf course this weekend, damn it, Amy. So she's going out. Trust me, with this kind of weather, we got to figure out something, guys. I've had my minute. Thank you, guys.
All
have
right.
a good weekend.
Thanks for the call, Ziff. Yeah, I mean, it's so dramatic, this election, that probably as many as 1 in 3 registered voters will actually participate. Golly. Tom, Blue Island.
Hey, good morning, Dan and Amy. Dan, thank you for returning last Friday. Amy turns your radio show into Democrat Hack Central.
I did not. Stop it.
Hey,
be nice, Tom.
I,
boy.
I'm just kidding, Amy.
Coming in swinging.
Hey, yeah, I've been crunching numbers like John in Bridgeport.
Yeah.
I've been doing it in my garage while drinking a case of beer, and I think we're going to know the election is rigged if Brandon Johnson gets 81 million votes, just like Let's Go Brandon did in 2020.
All right, Tom. Steve Arlen Park.
Yeah, I have a question. Good morning, everybody. Are judges responsible in any way for the turnstile-type courts that some of them conduct? Is this catch and release immediately, or what? Or why aren't the records shown when people go vote on ballots as far as their success rate?
I got to tell you something. That's actually a really good point. Thanks for the call, Steve. There's nothing really like that. I've had conversations with people about doing a judicial project because you get ballots like you did in November, and you're in Cook County, and you got 70 judges that you're supposed to go through and supposed to be able to tell who's who. And of course, everybody just votes based on last name because we're a tribal city. And what's to choose from anyway? Everybody's Irish, even the non-Irish are Irish. But there does need to be an accounting beyond Tim Evans of these judges, some way to memorialize their record and measure it and be able to compare and contrast it with other judges in a circuit court that are responsible for imposing sentence in these criminal trials in particular. And it's something that maybe we'll revisit this spring or summer after the election. But it's a really good point. That's part of the reason there's no accountability is because these records are, you know, basically they're knowable, although it's not easy. They're not like volunteering them, but they are knowable. They're complicating factors, of course, but sentencing guidelines and what prosecutors ask for and the record of the defendant. So it's not easy to necessarily standardize a rating system. But, you know, like a voting record for a politician, you can take some key indicators and make some judgments. I think it's a really good idea. We don't talk about it enough, but that's something that really is demanded, particularly where you have big urban centers lorded over by Soros-funded decarceration, non-prosecution politicians. Jim Mokina.
Yeah, hi. I'm just calling because I want to remind everybody about the Wisconsin Supreme Court race on April 4th.
Yeah, big one.
It's very critical. The court is 4-3 now, and the Dem candidate, she's actually calling for new legislative maps. She wants to flip the whole state. It's April 4th, and I hope Chuck and Delavan will get out and vote.
There you go. Daniel Kelly is the it's a nonpartisan race, but it's clearly left versus right, originalist versus activist. Daniel Kelly is the guy to vote for in that Wisconsin Supreme Court race for all our cheeseheads listening. Speaking of which, Chuck and Delavan.
Hey, I already voted 20 times. I want to talk about driving in from Indiana before I was Chuck from Delavan. You would go past the Jay's Potato Chip Factory, and you'd go from two lanes into seven, and then there'd be like vintage deuce and a quarters coming down the ramps off 95th and 87th. They'd veer far to the left. Then they'd hurry up, and I said, turn around and step on it in less than a half mile, and it'd be headed for the locals, cutting you off again. You know, stock car drivers couldn't even get through there, but I got through there without maybe one or two accidents. And hey, when you were talking about earlier when boys were swimming with girls, why isn't there any family members doing like a Tanya Harding thing where they catch them in the hallway?
Okay.
So anyway, you guys have a great weekend. I'll be at the Abbey tomorrow night dancing my little feet off, and I might even bring out my white dancing shoes. It's against the rules.
And Chuck's a great dancer.
Bringing them out.
I would tweet out a picture of you and I dancing, but I don't have Twitter anymore. So.
Thanks for the call, Chuck.
Thanks.
Maybe someday you'll be on Twitter again. Dan and Amy, Chicago's Morning Answer.
If you're talking about it, Dan and Amy are talking about it. It's Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.